simply ravishing a four-length lead, moving into the final furlong. Now it's out to five. Travel Column is in a tussle for that second spot, along with Crazy Beautiful, well behind Simply Ravishing. Luis Saez aboard. It is all Simply Ravishing in the Darley Alcibiades. Opened up and won it by seven.
You're listening to the Thoroughbred Post on the Equisport Radio Network. Brought to you by Ballyrose Farm, Dunhill Real Estate, and Racetrack Supply. Join our guests, Meg Levy, Dr. Stephanie Walborn, Avalon Hunter, and Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation's Kim Ware. And now from Ballyrose Farm, here's our host, Les Saltzman.
Good morning and welcome to the show. This is Les Saltzman on the Thoroughbred Post. We're actually poolside here at Ballyrose Farm, and I've got a great guest with us this morning, Meg Levy. Meg, welcome to the show.
Hi, Les. How are you?
Good. We were talking before we went on the air. You just got back from Phoenix, and you're back to chilly Lexington right now, and you adjusted yet?
Gosh, you know, when you said poolside, I'm looking outside, and there's still about 4 inches of snow on the ground, so... It's very difficult adjustment this morning, Les, but I appreciate the question.
Now, Meg, you started Blue Water Sales, what, in 1998, was it?
1999, very close, yep.
Okay. And you're from down here in South Florida, so why don't you tell us a little bit of how that morphed?
Yeah, well, it's a long and winding road, as they say. I grew up in South Florida and was the only member of my family that was interested in horses. I was one of those little kids that just always wanted to ride, and no one really understood it. Thankfully, I did get the opportunity to ride in South Florida many years ago. I started out, you know, on ponies, sort of the traditional hunter-jumper route. And then by the time I got to college, I had a couple of horses. I went out to Texas to SMU, and I met a boy from Lexington. So ended up moving to Lexington after school and discovered an industry in that I could actually get paid rather than pay others. So it was I got to show horses. I got to break horses actually first, and then I discovered that you could show horses at the sales and make a career of it.
And that must have been a kind of an unusual transition, because in those days there weren't a lot of women who were running their own sales companies or consignment companies.
You are correct. In fact, if I can remember, there may have been really just one or two and a couple of bloodstock agents that I knew who were, you know, in the thoroughbred industry on their own. But I was very lucky to sort of fall into where I did. Eaton, Mr. Eaton, Lee Eaton, had a great company at the time. He was partners with a guy called Riley McDonald. And I met a gentleman called Bucky Reynolds, who had been in the show horse industry. And he came to the farm where I was working and decided to recruit me to show horses, to show yearlings for Eaton. So I ended up being the first female at the time, which sounds strange, you know, and I guess it was around 1990. It sounds strange that that would be the first female, but it really was.
Yeah, because in those days, I guess what Donna Wormser was down here maybe, and Becky Thomas mm-hmm. was just getting started, but you were few and far between.
Yeah, and Melinda Smith is up here, Pegasus Farm. So, there really weren't that many. Now the sales is covered with females, and you know, of course, plenty of riders and showmen as well.
And you broke in with a guy that, you know, as we get further and further down the timeline, people don't remember as much. But Lee Eaton was a tremendous horseman.
Oh, he was. And
to this day, I don't think there's a guy that could show a horse and get a horse to stand and present as well as him.
You are exactly right. I learned so many things. And he was a visionary in this time, because he actually took it on as a business. You know, the word consigner, or the idea of having a consigner, you know, kind of like a real estate agent to sell your horse for you rather than to have your farm manager and your farm team out there selling your own horse, or your own sort of stock, line of stock, yearling. But, he had some great ideas back in the day. He had books with people's pictures in it, and their names. And he had a whole other set of, he had a whole other skill set for bringing people together. And, you know, that company became one of the top ones at the time.
No, and then when Riley came over from Facebook Tipton, you know, they took it to another level, and it must have been kind of fun to be part of that.
Yeah, I consider myself very lucky. I mean, I met so many of the characters, the top most successful people in the thoroughbred industry just standing there holding the head of a horse. I can remember meeting Wayne Lucas, who gave me a lesson on how to ground tie a horse, told me to drop the shank to the ground, told me the filly would stand there. He's sort of looking around like, let's see. We're at the
it's amazing how that sticks with you, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But it's great having met. That's one of the benefits, I think, of working in the thoroughbred industry. You get, you know, they're no offensive, and you get to meet top people all the time and learn from whomever you meet.
I think, you know, one of the great things, and we kind of miss it a little bit now, is that July Keeneland yearling sale, because
yeah,
there was just about everybody there. And
yeah,
you're right.
It was a different world.
At every level.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it was a different world. So we'll see what happens in 2021. I think we escaped a lot of bullets in 2020, you know, still being able to have some horse sales. So, you know, it's a very resilient group of people.
Well, you had a very interesting year in 2020 because not only did you well at the sales, I think you did from an outsider looking in, it looked like you had great results with what you sold, but also you had some out of the sales ring results that were pretty spectacular. Why don't you tell us about that filly that we just heard at the beginning of the show?
Sure. 2020 was a very lucky year for us. You just can't make up the story, really. When I heard that call, the race call at the beginning, while I was waiting for you to come back on, I got chills. So starting out, it was actually in February when I went to buy a mare for $500 that needed a home. I had been on my way to the Phase of Tipton February sale, so somebody called me about a mare that, you know, was just not in a very good place. So I heard what her sire was. You know, she really didn't have any benefits, commercial appeal. But when I got there to see her, I just really liked the way she looked, and I loved the way she looked at me, to be honest. So I thought, well, maybe my husband won't find out that I'm on the test. So we picked her up. At the time we still had a breeding right, so a horse called Lauban. And he was standing in New York. So I decided to fold the foal that she was carrying, up there and send her back to breed to Lauban. And so she foaled that Lauban up there in New York, and the farm manager called me and said, you know, it's really nice filly, good size, you know, everything's in the right place, great. So I didn't really think much of it. And then she came down here to Kentucky, and my son, Ryder, was the first one to see the baby, and he sent me a picture that said, quote, Lauban / Four Wishes, looks like a whole bunch of New York Breeders Awards to me. So he just loved her from the start, and really we all did. So that baby grew up. We were intending to take her to the New York Bred Sale in Saratoga and hoping for, you know, very good results. And as luck would have it, that time I was already in Saratoga with the select consignment, which comes right before the preferred sale, you know, for New York breds. And so my farm crew was loading the horses. We had about 12 to go. And this filly had a bit of a temper and kicked the wall of the van so hard with her hind foot that she broke it.
Ouch.
So, yeah, she couldn't go. So back to the barn she went, and she ended up going to the Kentucky October sale, where thankfully Kenny McPeak put the shine to her and decided to buy her for $50,000. So we kept in touch kind of through the winter. You know, I'm sure he thought, oh my gosh, would they leave us alone, please? We just kept asking about her. And then, he said, yeah, she's doing pretty well. And she had a couple of works. And then right before she was due to run in Saratoga, he started texting us videos of her. And I thought, well, it can't be bad news that he's texting us videos. He might be happy about it. So, I just remember I took our farm manager to brunch on the weekend, and my phone, I actually missed the race, and my phone just started buzzing. You know, she won her first race by several lengths up there. And then, you know, it just kind of became a fairy tale for me after that, because the next race was the P.G. Johnson in Saratoga, which was supposed to be, her first race was on the grass, and the P.G. Johnson was supposed to be on the grass, and ended up being on the dirt, and she won that by several lengths. So the fact that she was then going to run in the Alcibiades, I thought, oh my goodness, could this really be? So on the day that she was due to run the Alcibiades, of course, it was during the pandemic, and Keeneland was empty because
right.
There were no fans. So really the only people involved, the only people that were there were people that were directly, you know, involved with the horses. So, you know, going over there, and we couldn't go into the paddock. We could only see, you know, from the outside. Looked great. We had a couple of our farm people who had raised her here with us, and we just sat there and watched as she came out of the gate, drew away. I mean, it was just, I can't even describe the feeling, you know, watching that filly go all the way around in front and draw away by six lengths. I mean, it was just, it just makes me want to cry thinking about it now. It just, you know, it all finally came home.
Is one good deed that got rewarded.
Yeah, exactly.
No, seriously, exactly. What you did, you know, a lot of people wouldn't do that, first of all. And then you had some good intuition with the horse. And from what I know, and we don't know each other well, but from what I know, this is not unusual for you to rescue a horse and bring a horse in. And so if anybody deserves it, you kind of deserve it.
Well, I was happy for the horse. I was happy. You know, it's a really special thing. And now I understand completely how all these breeders that I've worked with over the years feel. Because as an agent, you know, the horses like that cross the finish line, and the first thing we're doing is calling the breeder and see if they want to sell the mare, or, you know, see if they want to sell the half, or, you know, whatever. And now I can really feel firsthand what that emotion is like.
And you sold the mare, right?
No, we still have the mare.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Good. So,
yeah, I had a few calls, but I didn't feel like it was good karma.
But tell us a little bit about, as we're going into the spring season, what's happening at the farm right now, because you've got mares dropping probably every day.
Yes, in fact, Four Wishes is due on the 25th, which is Thursday. So she's the dam that's simply ravishing. She is, I'm a bit nervous. She's due to have a spitester.
Nice.
So, fingers crossed. See what happens. But
nice.
You know, we're just very grateful for all of that happening in 2020. And Simply Ravishing is now back on the work tab and getting ready to run. Kenny is pointing her towards the Ashland, and then hopefully the Kentucky Oaks.
Right. He was on the show last week, and he mentioned her.
Okay.
Now, also speaking of offspring. Your offspring, Ryder, is doing pretty well in his own right as a bloodstock agent.
Yes, he is. We've been very lucky that he has joined us in the business, and he's been managing a couple of clients and buying horses to race and doing a lot of the mating now, and breeding work.
Now, you have three sons, am I correct?
Yes, Ryder's the eldest.
Okay, and the other boys, are they interested in the business as well?
Well, they're very interested in betting at this stage. they're both in college. Our second son is at Washington and Lee in Virginia studying business, and the third one is at SMU in Dallas. He's a sophomore, so. But they do enjoy the races, and that is one benefit. You know, the thoroughbred business really lends itself to being enjoyed by the whole family.
Now, I'm going to give you a untold story, okay, that you can pass on to your husband.
Okay.
So many, many, many years ago, when I was a young kid in Atlantic City, I worked for the Atlantic City Press. And I was a sports writer, and I was covering tennis. And the Atlantic City Racecourse had a women's tennis tournament that I wound up having to cover, and I got to meet Bob Levy. And over the years, we kept in touch, and then I decided to train, and no stalls. But he got me stalls at Atlantic City. So
nope,
Levy family is probably responsible for all this mess that I've created.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that is very interesting. I can't wait to tell Mike that story. Mr. Levy was influential.
Because we're such a small world, right? You know, and... But I'm going to let you go. I know you're busy. I'm thrilled that we had a chance to talk with you. We've, you know, been trying to get you on, and it's well worth it. And I hope you'll join us again. Let me know if you're heading down to the sales here in Florida. I'd love to meet up with you.
Sounds good, Les. Thank you very much.
Great.
Enjoyed it.
Meg, thanks. And we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Dr. Stephanie Wilborn of Root and Riddle.
Take care.
Thanks.
They are superstar athletes, but they don't ask for more money or go on strike. They bring their best every time they play. They are great thoroughbreds, retired and old friends.
And here's commentator turning for home in the Whitney with a three-length lead. And here's commentator to win the Whitney again. And boy, he did it with some front-running style today.
All commentator wants is a peppermint and to hang out with a couple of his pals, like Eclipse Award winners Hidden Lake and Sunshine Forever. Or even a Breeders' Cup champ.
Prize the surging Sierra Roberto toward the inside. A driving finish in the turf. And here's the wire. And it is prize.
Many of the past superstars of our sport are still running around. So come visit them at Old Friends in Georgetown, Kentucky. Or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Pin Oak Studs Alternation is a top 10 third crop sire by earnings, black type winners, and graded stakes winners. With nearly $7 million in earnings to date, Alternation was represented by six black type horses in 2019. From a second crop, three-year-old daughter Serengeti Empress won the 2019 Grade 1 Kentucky Oaks and was runner-up in both the Grade 1 Test and Acorn Stakes. Serengeti Empress finished the year with a strong third to older mares in the Breeders' Cup Distaff and is a finalist for Eclipse Champion three-year-old filly. By Distorted Humor, millionaire graded stakes winner Alternation stands at Pin Oak Stud.
And welcome back. We're with Dr. Stephanie Wilborn of Root and Riddle in Wellington. Stephanie is our reproductive vet of choice. Does a great job with mares and foals. And Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Les. I'm really happy to be here.
I appreciate you taking your time. This time of year is your busy time, and I appreciate you spending some time with us. I guess your shoulder holding up okay?
So far, so good. But I know by the end of the season, I probably won't be saying those words.
So tell us a little bit about your practice with Root and Riddle, and then we'll talk about how we get mares ready this time of year.
Perfect. So I, like Les said, I work for Root and Riddle Equine Hospital down here in Wellington. We are one of two satellite practices that Root and Riddle, our main hospital in Kentucky has. We are down here in Florida, and then we have another satellite practice up in Saratoga Springs, New York. Being that we are in the show horse capital of the world down here, most of my breeding work is performed on warbloods, but I've been lucky enough to work with a few thoroughbred breeders like Les himself and work on thoroughbred mares as well. A little bit about myself. I was raised down in South Florida, and I went to the University of Florida for both undergrad and veterinary school. So I will say go Gators, and for all of you Seminoles fans out there, I'm sorry.
How about us Hurricane fans?
Yeah, or Hurricane fans, that's right. But I don't know if there's too much of a competition there, but I won't say that too loudly. So I did an internship after I graduated from vet school in Ocala at the Equine Medical Center of Ocala, and then went off to do a reproductive residency at Texas A&M. When I finished up there, I came back here to Florida. My goal was to, you know, to come back down here where family was and to be involved in mostly sport horse breeding and some reproductive work. So that's a little bit about me. And yeah.
Well, tell us. You know, we're now, for us thoroughbred folks, you know, the breeding shed opened up this week, and people are getting their mares ready. But what are you guys seeing this year? Because every year, it seems like there's something that we've got to be aware of.
Yeah, so, you know, so far, everything has been somewhat status quo, especially for me down here. I think that it's hard for me to comment on Kentucky since I see a little bit of a different population of mares down here. But like you said, certainly the breeding sheds are open. So I think as the season progresses, we may see a little bit more of what is coming. Like last year, we had a large increase in the number of necardiform placentitis mares that we saw and abortions due to that cause. I'm hoping that we don't see the same this year. But, you know, only time will tell.
Yeah, yeah. With vaccines being like the main word in our vocabulary these days, what should we be doing to vaccinate our mares that are in foal, getting ready to have their foals, and maiden mares? What should we be doing as far as vaccinating those folks?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we should treat our pregnant mares, especially prior to breeding, as any other mare. So I guess our maiden mares is what I'll talk about first. And they typically are get treated just like any other horse we have on our in our facilities. Typically do our core vaccinations usually prior to breeding, and our core vaccinations being tetanus, our eastern, western Venezuelan encephalitis, rabies, I'm blanking on the last one, West Nile. I apologize for that. And especially down here in Florida where, you know, mosquito season is pretty much year round, I think that those are really important for us to do. So typically I have, my breeders vaccinate prior to the breeding season. That could be in the fall. And then, again in the springtime. Now, most of these vaccines are safe for pregnant mares, so we usually don't see any problems with them. I typically, if we do breed our mares within the first 30 and 60 days, I don't vaccinate them. I just want their placenta to start producing some hormones to help us out and help sustain that pregnancy before we vaccinate them. So usually later in the season, like April, May time for those girls. And then we always have to think about some of the abortifacient viruses that can occur during gestation. So those would be our equine herpes virus. So we're definitely having folks vaccinate their mares or having their veterinarians vaccinate mares against EHV1, so equine herpes virus 1, at 5, 7, and 9 months of gestation. And even in some locations around the country, I know people are vaccinating as early as 3 months because that's one of our most common causes of infectious abortion in mares.
Hey, one of my clients asked me to talk to you about this. EPM in pregnant mares, is it an issue? Is it treatable? First of all, should you breed an EPM mare? And then secondly, what if you do, can she carry to term, and what are the problems with that?
I think they can definitely carry to term. One of the things is EPM can be extremely variable in horses, and can be extremely severe or could be extremely mild. So I think it's, you know, working with your veterinarian and figuring out what kind of neurologic abnormalities you're seeing due to EPM and whether or not that mare is going to be able to carry to term based on that, I think is really important before you even think about breeding them.
Now, if you do breed one and you get the foal, is it likely that the EPM is a transmittable type of situation?
I do not think so, Les, but I'm not 100% certain. I don't think that it transmits through the placenta.
What types of things should a breeder be concerned about transmitting long-term from the mare?
I think any sort of genetic or congenital abnormalities are important to think about. And before breeding our mares, we definitely take a look at, you know, their conformation, I think is important, as well as any other congenital abnormalities that they may have. So looking at their eyes, seeing if they have cataracts or things like that, is definitely important prior to breeding. And then I guess it just depends on breeding pedigrees too, which is not my forte. And you can say more about that than I can, especially in the thoroughbreds list, but taking a look at some of the things that that previous generations have had, especially if you're breeding to ones that have specific abnormalities within their pedigrees.
And then once they foal, because now you're starting to foal these babies now, what should the typical owner be looking for, and when do you call the vet?
I think definitely we have our, you know, 1-2-3 rule that we always tell owners that the foal should be standing by 1 hour post-foaling, nursing by 2, and the mare should have passed her placenta by 3 hours post-foaling. So I think keeping that in mind is really important. And if those things aren't happening right at those times, sometimes we can give some mares and foals a little bit of leeway, but I don't really like to give them too much leeway, as we want to be there as soon as possible in order to prevent any problems from occurring and just have some early intervention.
Now, we know, unfortunately or fortunately, well, unfortunately, that most mares wait at least until the owner is about to fall asleep and the vet is thinking about falling asleep.
Yes, so, absolutely. They don't really care about our lifestyle, right?
Right. So I guess, we have cameras in our stalls. A lot of people are starting to do that, but sometimes you don't. And you miss the foaling.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't know if the foal has gotten up within the hour or, you know, what the time frame is. In a situation like that, is it a good idea just to call the vet anyhow?
Yeah, I think so, especially when you don't know the exact time of foaling. Usually if I have clients that have witnessed a foaling, I'll come out, you know, 8 to 12 hours later and check the foal. Because at that time we can do a really good physical exam. We can check antibody levels, IgG levels on the foals and make sure that they at least are normal at that time. And kind of make a decision as to whether or not we need to supplement those IgGs or we can wait a little bit longer. So I think if you don't know exactly when the foal was born, I think it's definitely a good idea to have the vet out the next morning to at least make sure everything's normal and not to neglect the mare as well, because it may be that she still hasn't passed her placenta or she has some sort of placental tag still within the uterus. So I think we have to look at both of them, you know, just to make sure everybody is healthy. One of the things that if you don't have a nice video camera system, there's some tools that you can utilize, such as a foal alert. It's basically a transducer that your veterinarian can attach to the vulva of the mare. And when the mare goes into labor, that the transducer actually opens up and it sends a signal to basically a radio that you have in your house with a really loud noise, as well as you can program it to give you a call on your cell phone as well as other people a call. So sometimes I have owners that will put me on the call list for that as well. So I will get a phone call right as the mare is foaling, so I know exactly what happened. I can check in with them. If they're there, they can let me know exactly what's going on, if we need to do any sort of intervention. So I think that if you don't have a video system, which those can be pretty pricey, at least trying to invest in something like a full alert, or a lot of people have interns that come in and do full watch, which I think is really important as well. But we do know that especially some of our maiden mares, if they're being watched a lot, they will keep their full. So they don't like to full, when they're being watched. So I think that that's something to think about as well. Another thing we didn't touch on that maybe it's a good thing to talk about is a little bit about what to do kind of in the fall, maybe early winter with your mares, especially if they're either maiden, barren, or even if they're pregnant and we're bred early in the season. I think it's important for us to talk about putting them under lights, which is something that most people do starting on December 1st. And the reason to do that is that usually the physiologic breeding season in the mare is about April to October, but we all want that January 1st baby. So we want to try to hasten the seasonality of these mares and get them to come into heat much sooner than, let's say, April. So we start them under lights in December. So usually December 1st is the day that I tell everybody to start doing that. And you know, it's really easy to do. You can take advantage of natural light and then add additional light at the end of the day. Some people utilize timers. Some people utilize just going into the barn late at night and turning off those lights. So as long as the mares are getting about 14 to 16 hours of the day, of light a day, we can see some hastening of their seasonality, and they have to be under this protocol for at least 60 days for us to see a response, which is good because that leads us to the beginning of February, which is typically when all our breeding sheds are opening up anyways.
No, I agree with you. I think that's paramount, especially with young mares. Stephanie, what other inside tips do you have for us?
Inside tips.
How can we do it better?
How can we do it better? Oh, if I had the answer to that, I'd be a millionaire, I think.
Oh, you do though. But one of the things, let's talk about real quickly, bedding mares foaling. Because
I'm sorry. I didn't hear what you said.
No, let's talk real quickly about bedding on the night that the mare is foaling.
Oh,
what
absolutely.
Kind of bedding do you want to use?
Yes, I typically like to use straw. I just think that's much nicer for the foals, especially foals are recumbent a lot of the time, and sometimes really fine particles of shavings can get into their eyes and cause some corneal abrasions. So I will have owners bed on straw. I also have owners, once the mare waxes up, has that nice, thick exudate at the end of her teeth, have them wrap the mare's tail, wash her udder as well, just try to keep everything as clean as possible. And I think cleanliness is one of the most important things, especially with bedding, getting all of the manure out of the stall, especially before the mare is going to foal. You want a clean environment for that foal to be born into to help decrease any pathologies that could occur.
Excellent. Those are great tips. Stephanie, I appreciate you taking the time. This is a busy time for you. We'll hopefully grab you again before the end of the breeding season, if that's okay. And we'll let you get back to work.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
And we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with Avalyn Hunter, who is my go-to pedigree analysis. So we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
When you head to a horse sale, either looking to buy or sell, you really don't know what's going to happen. In the blink of an eye, horses can leave the ring undersold or overpriced. But what if there was a better way to ensure a fair market price for both the buyer and seller? Here at The Stable, this fall, we're offering just that. We offer the ability to see your yearlings hard at work while giving you a better chance to make informed decisions that are calculated, not spur of the moment. We'll also provide in-depth commentary from our trainers, blacksmiths, and veterinarians on how each horse is progressing.
Hi, this is Les Salzman, and we're back on the show. Avalyn Hunter is probably my favorite author, and probably the best person to read if you're interested in pedigrees. I don't mean to make you blush. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Les. That's a pretty flattering introduction.
Now, you're in Murfreesboro, Tennessee?
No, actually, I grew up there, but I live in North Florida now.
Oh, okay. My daughter lives in Columbia, just down the road from Murfreesboro.
The home of the annual mule celebration.
That's right. You can't believe the stuff she sends us for gifts. But and you're in North Florida now, am I correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So tell me, let's talk about your website first.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell the people the address and tell us how you got started with it, because it is fascinating.
Okay, it's www.AmericanClassicPedigrees.com. And what it is, it grew out of a book I wrote earlier called American Classic Pedigrees, 1914 through 2002. And this was published by Eclipse Press in 2003. And I felt the need to update the information there and to put it in a format that could be reached more widely. And so that's how the website came to be. It's still very much a work in progress. I think I have about 1,400 entries in there right now.
It's amazing. And I get a kick out of it because every Monday I, go through my emails for the weekend, and then I go right to your site to see what you've posted over the weekend. And it's so timely, but it's not timely like the mainstream type of website that just gives you kind of, well, this one's out of this one, but you really look at the pedigree and the history of the pedigree and the depth of it. And I think that's something that's really, really missing in the industry right now when we're looking at buying horses or even getting ready to breed horses.
Oh, you're looking at the Mayor's on Monday post then?
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
But tell us a little bit about the process, how you go about pulling all that information and the history. Were you a history student at one point, or?
No, my husband is the history buff. That's what he teaches. But, okay. No, I do take a historical perspective on this, because when you're dealing with a genealogy, whether you're talking about human or you're talking about equine, you're talking about a whole tree of ancestors and the influence they wield on their descendants. Now, obviously, with human ancestry, part of the influence wielded is through stories. And as far as I know, horses don't tell stories about their heroic ancestors to each other.
This is true.
But each pedigree, if you will, is a story. Each name in it is attached to an animal that had certain characteristics, did certain things, had a certain temperament, and all that. And the more familiar you are with what those names in a pedigree actually mean, the more you can kind of guess what may come out in a given offspring. It's by no means an exact science, because you never know precisely what genes a foal has inherited from a given ancestor. And you also don't necessarily know what a horse is going to throw based on its own expressed phenotype. For instance, Secretariat, when they started breeding him, they thought he would throw like Bold Ruler, his daddy. And Bold Ruler was more of a speed influence. So they were getting all these classic type mares for him. But it turned out that while Secretariat did tend to stamp his offspring in certain physical ways, such as that big strong rear end and a very attractive head, when it came to stamina and the like, he tended to throw more like Prince Quillo, his maternal grandfather. And so they found that getting him mares that were quicker or had ancestry close up from quick horses worked better with him.
Which I think was so interesting, because even body types of the mares that he was bred to originally and towards the mid part of his career changed drastically over a period of three or four seasons. Am I correct?
Correct, because people finally started figuring out that what he needed was not a classic type mare, but more of a miler speed type of mare with a bit more power and muscle. Now, in that sense, Richard Starr was really an outlier because his mare was a tall, his dam was a tall, scopey kind of classic mare, but she was the exception to the rule.
Now, you not only look at American bloodlines, but you're looking at the European bloodlines as well.
I'm looking at them mostly as they impact on American bloodlines, because frankly, when you're dealing with thoroughbreds worldwide, you know, it just gets too big for one person's mind to handle. There may be some genius out there that can keep everything on track from Australia and Brazil and England and whatnot, but I'm afraid that's not me. So.
Well, you're doing an amazing job, because I'll come up with the mare's name and then I'll look up at her sire's name and, you know, somebody that's totally obscure, and I'll go onto the site and there it is, you know, in 1922, yep, so and so and so and so, and then I'll trace it back, and then 1864. Yeah, I don't know how you do it.
it's
got to be a labor of love.
It is very much so. I mean, I've been studying this since I was around 13 or 14. So,
what did something? I mean, because you don't get through kindergarten and say, I want to analyze pedigrees. What kind of triggered it?
I really couldn't say for certain what became fascinating about looking back into the families of these animals. I know that Secretariat's Belmont Win was probably a big perk in just being interested in the whole deal, and then reading C.W. Anderson's horse books, particularly his things about Man of War and Fair Play, because of course he was a great admirer of that sire line.
Right. And did you have family that were in the thoroughbred business, or?
No, I'm kind of a sport in that regard. My father took a photograph when I was only about 3 years old, and we were living in the Louisville area at the time. And photograph shows me trying to climb into a field full of broodmares. There was just bad attraction from the start. Now my dad did attend Northern Dancers Kentucky Derby, but he wasn't really into the horse thing, and my mother wasn't horsey, so they're still of course my father's passed on now. Mother is still trying to figure out about her nutty daughter.
it's interesting how you became attracted to it and then kind of built a side career, because you do something completely different in the real world, right?
Well, for a good many years, I had worked in mental health, and I don't even want to go into all that stuff there, because
okay.
It's pretty wild,
there was a reason I brought that up, though,
mm-hmm.
because the analytic of when you're looking at bloodlines and stuff like that, and I've noticed this in a lot of your writing, is that you're talking about confirmation and pedigree and stuff like that, but quite frequently you're talking about behavioral traits in a bloodline as well. And I was wondering if any of that is kind of a flow from your previous experience.
I don't know if it is a flow from previous experience, but it does make just practical common sense that if an animal is an extreme temperamentally, it's going to be a lot harder to get the best from that animal than it is to get an animal who has what you call kind of the ideal temperament, one that's alert and interested, but relaxed until it's called upon to put on some effort.
Now, right now, of the young stallions that have come to the market, who do you kind of like as the prototypical type of stallion?
Well, probably right now in the American market, Into Mischief is about as prototypical as they come. And, of course, he's getting into the middle part of his career at this point. But,
yeah.
You know, he was as far as we can tell from the racetrack, because he really didn't get a chance to try much at longer distances, but he was essentially, at the very least, a good miler who could carry his speed for an extended mile. And he has that kind of balanced body type that is neither very blocky nor very long and rangy, which means that he fits a lot of the mare population.
And I guess that's why he's done so well with such a variety of mares.
Right. Generally, if you see a stallion that's doing well with a very wide variety of mare types, you can be pretty sure that guy has a very balanced body type, whether you're talking about a 15-2 Northern Dancer or whether you're talking about a guy like Dynaformer who stood 17 hands.
Yep. We have an Into Mischief here at the farm, and it's funny because we got her as a 3-year-old, and now as she's going into her 4-year-old year, she's changed.
Mm-hmm.
And in looking at a lot of Into Mischiefs, they seem to also get that late bloom, even though they run early.
Mm-hmm. You know?
So he's, to me, he's just a very, he's almost into mystical, you know, because there's so much that goes on with him.
Right. And you saw the same sort of characteristics with horses like Mr. Prospector. For instance, he raced almost solely as a sprinter. You had to dig into his race record to find out that, you know, he may have had more distance capacity than he ever got a real chance to show because he was rushed to make the Derby as a 3-year-old, got hurt, and was struggling with soundness problems ever after that. But he was able to combine mares he saw to throw anything from brilliant speed to horses that could stay long distances.
And, well, I think Mr. Prospector is a great example of not really being able to forecast exactly what that foal is going to look like as well. Because if you looked at him, you'd say, well, you know, he's this, he's that, you know. And then you get a little bit different type of foal.
Well, yes and no, because he did tend to stamp his foals pretty strongly with certain characteristics. And the biggest one that was probably important for racing ability was a very strong set of hindquarters and a hind leg that was pretty straight and able to deliver a lot of power. Not post leg, you know, not the lack of angulation in the hock.
Right.
But without any of the rotational deviations, without sickle hocks and everything. So you had a hind leg that was just about perfect for a dirt racer. And he would stamp his foals pretty consistently with that.
And up front?
Up front, you tended to see a little bit of the front right foot turnout.
Right.
Which on American racing, as long as it's not really severe, is not necessarily a huge handicap because we do our racing counterclockwise.
Exactly. Exactly. So many people overlook that or don't calculate that when they're looking at a 2-year-old or a yearling at the sale. You know, they say, oh, well, he toes out. But, you know, they don't realize that, you know, he's toeing out to the right. Yeah.
Well, it's also a case of how far down the leg is the rotational deviation. And I don't consider myself a conformation expert. But from what I know of it, the further down the leg it has the rotational deviation occurs, the less problematic it tends to be. And then obviously the degree is also important.
Exactly.
So if you have a horse that toes out, you know, mildly from the ankle, that's probably not a huge concern. If it's from the knee, you got to look a little bit more, not only because the deviation is occurring higher up in the leg, which is going to change the mechanics, but also if you have that rotation there, you may also have a horse that's more likely to have an offset knee.
And further problems through the shoulder and all. And that makes tremendous sense. Now, I'm going to let you go in just a couple of seconds, but tell me, I know you're working on another book. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Or will you always be working on another book?
In some ways, it's always, but right now, the current project that I am really pouring into is a manuscript on black gold, the 1924 Kentucky Derby winner.
And oh, sure nice.
And I'm sure you know something about the legend behind that horse. What I'm digging into now is newspapers and things that are a century old and trying to look behind the legend of what was really there.
That'd be fascinating.
And it's quite a story because it ties in with a lot of things that were going on in the time, both racially and socially among human beings, and then also in the horse racing world itself.
You know, my wife is doing she's an artist, and she does a lot of equine art for various organizations. She's doing a series of black jockeys, and that's how I became, you know, familiar with the story. If it's okay with you, could we get you back on the show, and you can talk about that a little bit?
Sure, no problem.
Okay, good. And I'm going to let you go right now, but I appreciate the time. And again, if I can call you from time to time, you're just so valuable. I got to tell you, you to me, you're like a national treasure. You and Ursula Ellis, you know, and I'm putting you in good company because he's one of my favorite people. So, if it's okay, I'd love to be able to give you a call again.
No problem.
Great. Thanks for joining us. We're going to take a quick break. Then we're going to get Kim Weir on the phone from the TRF. They've got exciting new news.
They are superstar athletes, but they don't ask for more money or go on strike. They bring their best every time they play. They are great thoroughbreds, retired and old friends.
And here's commentator turning for home in the Whitney with a three-length lead. And here's commentator to win the Whitney again. And boy, he did it with some front-running style today.
All commentator wants is a peppermint and to hang out with a couple of his pals, like the Clips Award winners Hidden Lake and Sunshine Forever, or even a Breeders' Cup champ.
Prize the surging Sierra Roberto toward the inside. A driving finish in the turf. And here's the wire. And it is prize.
Many of the past superstars of our sport are still running around. So come visit them at Old Friends in Georgetown, Kentucky, or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
And we're back again, and our guest right now is Kim Weir from the TRF, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. And I'm not going to give her a lot of introduction because she's got really big news that she's kind of bursting to tell us about. So, Kim, why don't you go ahead?
Oh, I'm so happy to do it, Les. Thank you for having me, and thank you for letting me share this exciting news. So it is. It's like breaking news. We will tomorrow be introducing the world, starting with your listeners, to the first ever in the country of its kind TRF Second Chances Juvenile Program at CSI Ocala. This is a big deal. This is a big deal for us, for sure, as a little nonprofit that's been doing our work for a long time. But we hope it's also really big news for the industry and for the world, where we are putting our horses in a situation where they will be literally changing the trajectory of young lives in Ocala. So that's my story, and I'll tell you all about it.
Yeah, and I want you to give us some detail, because what you're doing is totally unique. We know the great work that TRF has done with adult incarcerated people, both men and women. Yeah. You're in, what, seven states now?
That's right. We're in seven states across the country.
And now you've got probably the most vulnerable inmate population, the kids,
yep.
And you're reaching back into that group. And tell us what you're doing, how you're doing it, because this is pretty different.
It is. It is. It's building on a lot of learning and experience, but it's also really braving a new trail and starting a new chapter. So, what we are doing is absolutely positively a partnership. The TRF does not work alone in these programs, in any of our programs across the country. When the TRF Second Chances program comes to life, it is through partnership, and I very much call that a private-public partnership, because we are simply and proudly a nonprofit charity that raises money to take care of retired racehorses, and that's what we do. But when we link our wagons to these partners, in this case, it's the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice, that partner is the key because they're in the business of helping humans. And so to do this for the first time with a juvenile justice program is giving us the chance to use what we've learned over 35 years of having our horses act as teachers. We're doing that now with the same premise of vocational, educational, skills-based learning and teaching, but we're also wrapping it in the therapeutic benefits that horses give to people, and especially to these young people. This program in Ocala is a residential DJJ facility. It's called CSI Ocala. That stands for Center for Success and Independence, but there's a lot of acronyms in the government world. So this residential facility is specifically for young men, and they are ages 12 to 18. So they have found themselves in this facility through some encounter with the law and a judge who has adjudicated them and said this would be the best next place for them to go to get themselves back on a positive path. So this is who these boys are. These youth are in this facility. Our program, the Second Chances program, is one of many that are put together by the juvenile justice to give these young men things to work through, things to work on, information, experiences. You know, all of it is that eye-opening opportunity for young men to experience a horse like you and I have done for all of our lives, Les, but to give these young men who haven't likely had that experience, and then to give it in a way that is paving a path towards a future, and to show how these horses can not only help them be better today, feel better about themselves, learn some critical skills as humans and as young people, but also to open their eyes to the path of workforce, whether that be with the farrier or with the veterinarian or training horses or even just caring for horses. There's a really wonderful mix of things happening at this program. So I'm so excited that I'm not so sure I'm painting the picture clearly, but it's really good stuff. And we're going to show everyone what I'm talking about tomorrow at 10 a.m.
Actually, why don't you send me the link to that?
Okay.
And I will put it on the website. And we'll tweet it out and spread the word.
What you're doing,
what you're doing is kind of amazing because you're working within a very, very stringent prison environment.
Yes.
And tell us about your personnel, and then also let's talk about, before we do that, let's talk about the horses.
Okay, love
because
that.
Because the horses that you're bringing in, they're not your typical type of horses.
That is very true. It does start with the horses. Certainly when I tell the story of these programs, we start with the horses. They are who bring us into these opportunities, and they are who bring us to this conversation. So the horses that they're in our herd, so we're not just working with them. They are ours as horses that belong to the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. We specifically take in horses to our herd who are couple different things. They are first and foremost thoroughbred racehorses. They have been bred and they have jockey club papers that document that they are of the thoroughbred breed. Secondly, they have all raced. This is an important thing, just for the mission that we have is to save thoroughbred racehorses that are no longer able to compete on the racetrack from possible neglect, abuse, and slaughter. So it is important to us that they have raced, even if they just ran that one race, but they have raced. And then the population that we have the unique honor of serving are those horses who, for a whole host of reasons, are not able to pursue a second athletic career. That is almost entirely from an injury, although we do also take horses into our herd at a very ripe and senior age. So it's either age and or injury, but they at this point in their lives, when they come to us, can't do that next career. They're physically unable.
Half-heartedly, I call your herd the Statue of Liberty herd.
Oh.
Because, you know, what does it say on the Statue of Liberty? Give us your tired, your poor, and huddled masses.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I love it.
and the horses that you guys take in are horses that nobody else is even looking at.
That's exactly right. And, you know, they each have a story. They've each given their all. They may or may not have ever hit the board, but they are, we do have an awful lot of the everyman of the horse world. And then the huddled masses is some, on a day like today, they probably are kind of huddled in their little herds with the weather.
Right.
Of course, I'm in New York. Your weather is probably once again 80 degrees and sunny less, but you're right. These horses are special. And that's for us. We really are just so proud to play our role, which is just one role of many in the aftercare ecosystem, but we are specifically focused on the ones that otherwise would be at greater risk because they can't do the things that we want them to do, which is what they all would love to do when their racing careers are over. So we have that kind of a vulnerable bunch, but that is where some of the really powerful magic comes when you put them in a program like our Second Chances program. So you have essentially sort of the cast off horses of the racing world, you might say. They're not, you know, we don't want to overplay that, but they are a little bit of the left behind. And in our Second Chances program, we are giving them the chance to help those humans who may also be feeling somewhat left behind or cast aside. Those who are vulnerable, those who aren't looked at as valuable today. But you put the two together and sort of like extraordinary things happen because they both find each other in one another. You know, they find that they can help each other. So our little tagline that we use is saving horses, saving lives. But I also think we realize that we are helping horses and the horses are healing and helping us too. And that's the cycle that is happening in all of our care of Second Chances programs. We do have the 7 across the country and 7 different correctional facilities. But to do all of that and to put it in the youth environment, for us, we really are just so excited to tell you about it today, to show the world tomorrow. And then, of course, we're most excited about what happens next. It's where do these young men go? How can we feel together? And it does take a village. Let me say, Les, it takes you and your amazing platform to give me the chance to tell the story. It takes everyone listening to hear this and think, oh, I should either tell my friend about that, or maybe I should look into getting involved, or maybe I just feel like I want to give a dollar. That is, anything is possible if we all come together. And who knows what the outcome will be. Sorry, I've been talking about it a lot. I might be losing my voice.
You will never lose your voice.
You're right.
No,
you are right.
This is a great program, and we're excited about it. We're going to be touching base with you as we go along. I would like to maybe do something on site at either Lowell or there. And it's just great. And I thank you for coming on board with us. Get me that link so we can put it out to everybody. And
I sure will.
And then, Kim, we talked about this a while back. After the dust settles on this, you're going to get us profiles of some of the horses that are in the herd so we can share that with the public. Because I think their stories are very interesting.
They really, really are. And yes, so I think that this little conversation today and our event tomorrow is really just the beginning. You know, it actually gets more interesting after tomorrow when we've actually identified the characters in this new story, which is our program manager who you're going to meet tomorrow, Velvet Salisbury. You're going to meet the horses, several of the horses that are there. And as we go forward, I would love to share those stories. I'd love to start with the horses, like you said, because each of them have their own journey to our herd. And then as we go forward over the year, you know, I'm going to have plenty to talk about whenever you give me a chance, Les, because we also have this women's prison program that is right next door to the juvenile facility. And that program has like dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of success stories that we can tell together. So I'm awfully excited, of course, about all of these things, but especially to be with you today, the day before, the eve of our launch of a groundbreaking new program. I will absolutely send you the link, and I would just let your whole listening audience know that it's really easy to join us tomorrow. This is a live-streamed event. There's no tickets. There's no registration. You just click on either our website, the link that Les will give you, or our website is trfinc.org. And you can watch it on YouTube. You can watch it on Facebook, and you can just feel like you're there in Ocala, feeling like you're there on a historic day in the history of the TRF. So that's how it works. It's quite easy.
Well, we're going to look forward to that and having you back on the air. And we thank you and wish you all the luck in the world. We're going to sign off now and thank all our listeners. This is Les Salzman on the Thoroughbred Post. We'll see you real soon.